Good morning. Please be seated. Several days ago, as I began to think, or maybe worry is a more accurate word, about what I was going to say in today's sermon, I came across a passage in a Forward Day by Day meditation that stuck in my mind. Of what are we afraid? Are we afraid because we lack faith? Or do we lack faith because we are afraid? And I remembered that both those words come up multiple times in today's gospel reading, so I began to ponder the interaction of faith and fear and how that concept might apply to today's lesson. Now, I know people have widely different reactions when a preacher talks about herself in a sermon, so I hope those of you who dislike that practice will indulge me for just a moment or two. As it happens, I'm not an expert on faith. I'm still working on mine. The strength of my belief in God and Jesus Christ waxes and wanes, and I can't articulate its roots or reasons. But I do know a good deal about fear. For long periods in my life, I was afraid every day. I was afraid of almost everything, almost all the time. I was afraid of my mother's bad temper, my father's cutting sarcasm, and my siblings' teasing. I was afraid of the classmates who bullied me for making good grades and afraid my teachers wouldn't like me if I didn't. I was afraid of the traits that made me unpopular and afraid of being untrue to myself if I tried to change them. I was afraid of the dark, afraid of other people, afraid I'd always be alone, and I was afraid of the dark power of my own fears. And I tell you that so you know what I bring to these gospel stories this morning. What I want to do is apply my experiences to our lesson in a way that's similar to Ignatian prayer, which is a practice in which we enter into a Bible story imaginatively, putting ourselves in the scene and feeling it with all our senses. I want to put flesh on the bare bones of these stories and to fill in some of the missing details so we can see what this lesson teaches us about faith and fear. Given that this is my technique and my goal, I admit that I'm hesitant to take on the story of Jairus and his daughter. I've never been a parent, and I tend to agree with those who would say that loving my nieces and nephews is not quite the same thing. I can imagine, but I can't know, the fear that Jairus must feel as his little daughter lies dying. And I know that some in our parish have felt that fear firsthand, and I don't want to presume to share it or to bring renewed pain to anyone. I think it's enough that we know that his fear is intense, that Jesus acknowledges the pain when he tells him to fear not, and that Jairus goes to Jesus with faith that he can help. I feel on safer ground talking about the woman who touches Jesus' cloak as he moves through the crowd toward Jairus' house. We're told very little about her. She doesn't even have a name. We know that she's had hemorrhages for 12 years. She's exhausted all her resources on doctors, and she's still getting worse. What else can we surmise about her? We know from the laws of the Hebrews laid out in Leviticus that a woman was considered unclean at the time of her monthly period and if she bled for any other reason. Anyone who touched her would be made unclean. In fact, anyone who touched anything she had touched was considered unclean. So if the woman in our story was married, she would have been forbidden to touch her husband or her children, and they wouldn't be able to touch her. She couldn't bathe her children, couldn't prepare meals for her family, couldn't embrace her husband. And if instead she was unmarried or a widow, presumably she would have had to live alone, an outcast who would leave her home only to try yet another physician or to buy food awkwardly, afraid of inadvertently tainting someone on the street. After 12 years, surely she is desperate with fear, terrified of spending the rest of her life in this prison of loneliness, dashed hopes, pain, and isolation. Is she afraid even to touch Jesus? Does she fear that her touch will soil him as it would anyone else? at least in the eyes of the religious authorities. After all she's been through and all the efforts she's made to find healing, how can she believe that the mere touch of his cloak will make her well? And yet she does. She is sure she will be healed if only she touches his clothes. And Mark tells us that she knows immediately that the hemorrhage has stopped. She feels in her body that she is healed. And Jesus has felt that power surge out of himself. He stops his entourage and asks, "Who touched him?" And again, we can imagine the fear this anonymous woman feels. She's been detected. She's been caught in the act. Will Jesus be angry? Is she going to be rejected again, an outcast all over again? Surely her heart is in her throat as she comes forward, trembling, and falls at his feet. What Jesus says to her is the most important line in this passage. He tells her, "Your faith has made you well." Six simple words. Your faith has made you well. And why does Jesus say that? Isn't it his power that has healed her? I think the answer is no, not completely, not alone. Remember what Jesus' followers just said. When he asks who touched him, they say, "Many in the crowd have pressed against him." But Jesus knows that his power has gone out to one person. And there's the implication that he knows someone has touched him with intent, in supplication and in faith. So Jesus' simple declaration, "Your faith has made you well," for me has a deep theological truth. It is indeed the woman's faith, her fervent belief that Jesus can heal her, that makes it possible for him to do so. It is our faith that makes it possible for Jesus to heal us. The next passage in Mark's gospel is Jesus' visit to his hometown of Nazareth. Do you remember that story? Jesus can do no works of power in his hometown because people don't believe in his abilities. God has endowed us with free will, and therefore God will not impose healing upon us against our free will. Jesus will do nothing for us until we ask for his help, until we reach out of our fear and out of our belief and touch his robes. So now we're back to that interaction of faith and fear. Is our faith strong enough to overcome our fear? Can we set our fears aside and reach out to the Lord for what we need, believing, as Jesus tells his followers, that we can ask and receive, knock and be admitted? I want to have the strength of faith that moves a father to risk ridicule and to jeopardize his place as head of the synagogue to save his dying child. I want the strength of faith that moves an ailing woman to buck the laws of her religious tradition and reach out for help from someone she knows in her soul, can save her. I want the strength of faith that enables families in Charleston to speak forgiveness to the man who gunned down their family members and friends in cold blood in the middle of a prayer meeting. I want the strength of faith that sustained the abolitionists and the suffragettes and the civil rights marchers. I want the strength of faith that fed those who strived so long for marriage equality. I said at the start of the sermon that I'm not an expert on faith, but I know this much to be true. Whenever I feel that my faith isn't strong enough, when I despair of having the kind of faith embodied by the people I just mentioned, I remember something else that Jesus told his disciples, that faith the size of a mustard seed will enable them to move mountains. And so I face my fears with confidence that all I have to do is reach beyond them to Jesus, to touch the hem of his robe, trusting that he will meet my human frailty with his divine power. He will do that for me, and he will do it for you. Amen.